position number 21296, Rule 5.
The double door then opened, and the second of the two Chinese came in, carrying a bamboo ladder. And they put the ladder up against the wall, and they took down the court clock. Everybody in the court saw this. These two chaps would be very quiet, so not disturb proceedings. And they disappeared with the court clock, and it was never seen again. I thought 10 out of 10 for initiative. The very next day, I came down for breakfast. We were in barracks, which were two stories, with a broad veranda round. And we all had bedrooms facing onto this broad veranda. And I came down to breakfast, and there were already a couple of officers there. And they both had no wristwatches, but a white band round their wrist where the wristwatch would have been. And they were discussing the fact that during the night, a bad man had come round the balcony into the rooms and pinched their wristwatches, which were, of course, Admiralty wristwatches. We were then joined by the Colonel for breakfast. And he said heartily, you know, what are you chaps talking about? I said, these silly chaps put their wristwatches on the bedside desk. The Colonel had a white thing, so I shut up. But quite a few people had lost their watches. The other thing was when we arrived in Hong Kong, speaking of Chinese initiative, I had been told when I boarded the ship leaving England, which was the HMS Raja, that I was to be in charge of food, which only meant actually that I was in charge of organising queues, nothing else. But when we got to Hong Kong, I was told that they put a scrambling net down the side of the ship. All the luggage would be thrown overboard, rolled down this scrambling net, and then there were a lot of jolly Chinese chaps on the quayside, and there was a railway system of flat cars with tiny little wheels ran in the tracks, and they would gather up the luggage and push it round to where it should go. But I had to get off the ship at about 5 o'clock in the morning with two army cooks, and I was to proceed to the diocesan school, which everybody called the diocesan school, as they do in China. And there I would find some cooking arrangements, army-type burners, and I would produce a meal for the 900 Marines who were aboard. They'd all get sandwiches for lunch, but when they came ashore, I'd have the meal ready. So we got into the jeep with our kit and off we went. The laughter was that the other officers who threw their kit over the side saw it gathered up by these jolly Chinese chaps who wheeled it out the dockyard and pinched it. But in my case, I found the diocesan school, found the basement. It was full of bits and pieces of people, used dressings and all kinds of filth. No cooking arrangements of any sort. So I was in a jeep, so I found a British soldier wandering about and asked him, you know, take me to your leaders. He was Royal Engineers. And they loaned me three or four cookers, a jerry can full of petrol, brushes and things like that. And we went back and shoveled all this stuff out of the basement, made a great big heap, doused it with petrol and burned it. Then the first thing we did with the stoves, of course, was to heat large containers of scalding water, washed out the basement, scrubbed it, and we got the meal going. We scrounged food from the army, stew of course, and we got it all going, and the lads came ashore from the boat, and at something like 10 o'clock at night they all got a hot meal, which I thought they ought to be jolly, jolly grateful. And I remember when they were all fed, taking a bucket full of stew into the officer's mess, which was a classroom, and everybody was very pleased to see me.
How do you feel now about having served in the Royal Marines and the Second World War?
Oh, I'm glad I did. I enjoyed it. I learned something. And it did me no harm when I wanted to become a partner in a London firm, the senior partner of whom was an ex-Marine. But, I mean, that's just a bit of good luck. But I was very fortunate in one or two respects. First of all, I knew what I wanted to do in civil life from the time I was 14. I don't know why, but when I was 14, I decided I wanted to be an architect. And I was lucky enough to get to university and do a couple of years before I went into the service. So when I came back, as I said to you, I deliberately took a boat that got me back in time for the start of the university term. And I say this because quite a lot, not a large number, but some people I knew had found it quite impossible to settle down in Civvy Street. They didn't know what to do. The man I mentioned, Ian Beadle, he was on the stock exchange in Newcastle. His family had been there before him. There was money in the family. They were buying and selling coal and other commodities. But he couldn't settle to it. His marriage broke up. His business life was non-existent. And he ended up working on a cross-channel ferry and died in his 50s. You know, they didn't know what they wanted to do, really. Whereas I never imagined, when I was in the Marines, that it was going to be a permanent job. I was never offered, of course, a permanent job. I was offered a chance to go into the colonial service. But I couldn't see any future in that because I couldn't see any future in the colonies.
Why is it difficult to settle down after an experience in the services and wartime?
Oh, I think because it is such an all-embracing activity in which you're completely immersed. Nothing in one's life ever seems as important as being involved in the war, doing your best for your own chaps, killing as many as you can of the other side. It becomes a sort of passion. Not really a passion. Instinct, that's the word. An instinctive way of life. Just as I said earlier, you never think about anything other than soya links for breakfast. You never think of any life outside of the little group. But I never had that problem. I knew what I wanted to do. And I never regarded the Marines as something I would do all my life. In fact, I think to have been in any branch of the service in peacetime would have struck me as being rather pointless.
So is all this something to do with the question of choice and choosing?
Yes, but one makes a choice against the background of one's experiences and knowledge. And as far as I'm concerned, to get out of working class, north of England, endless terrace houses, you know, beer and chips on Saturday, this isn't what I wanted. I wanted to lead what I thought was a better life.
But I was referring also to this business of life in a wartime being instinctive.
Oh, I think one is conditioned to it. I think that's the word. You know, I can actually remember the outbreak of war. The Prime Minister come on and say, you know, as from 11 o'clock we are at war with Germany. And I thought, well, you know, my grandfather was at war with Germany. Hitler's a bad man. Germans are bad people. They were a lot better when I met them. Among my extraordinary experiences with the Germans, I told you we only stayed one night anywhere because it was a rolling campaign. And one night we turned up at a farmhouse, the usual farmhouse. We had a German interpreter with us. And he came to me and he said, I've got you a bedroom in the farmhouse. And I said, I don't want a bedroom in the farmhouse. I want to sleep in the barn with my lads. Not because I love them, but because I'd be better defended. Oh, he said, but it's ever such a nice room. I've got you this room. So I said, well, all right, I suppose so. There's nothing going on. So I went into this farmhouse, little bedroom. I remember I slept with my Thompson submachine gun in bed beside me. But before that, I went down to the living room. There was a fire. And I had to sew something on my uniform. I forget now what it was. I'd either torn it or a button had come off or something. And I sat down. I had the usual housewife, so-called. Needle and thread and all that. And I was just about to start when what I then thought was an old woman came in. She was probably about 45. And she looked at me, didn't say anything, held her hand out, took my jacket, sat down opposite me and started sewing my button on. Now, I didn't say anything either. It was obvious what she wanted to do. It was obvious I was going to let her. And behind her there was a big sideboard. And on the sideboard there was a picture with a wreath round it. It was a picture of a young man in uniform, German uniform. So I stood up and she helped me put my jacket on. And then I pointed at the picture and I said some totally silly phrase about, you know, your kinder or something. And she nodded and she said, this was her son. And I said, Russia? And she said, yeah, Russia. And so she raised her hand. Do you know, she put her arm around me. Just like that. That's it. That's the end of the story. But complete and absolute communication, though neither of us could actually talk the other's language, and there was nothing in it, you know, sex or anything like that. I looked upon her as an old lady who'd lost her son. And she felt just the same as you or I would if we'd lost our son.
Were there any after effects for you of the Second World War?
No, not at the time. I had trouble seeing clearly for a while, and I went to the doctor and said, you're run down, and gave me a bottle. But I wasn't, there was really nothing wrong with me. But the funny thing was, on the 50th anniversary of D-Day, I had not been involved with ex-service things, but I went to Normandy to pay my respects. Got all involved in talking about D-Day and what happened and so on. And during the night I had a violent nightmare in which I had to approach a door. And I had a feeling there was something terrible on the other side of that door. And when I opened it, there was a great black cloud which came out and rolled me over and over and over and pinned me against a fence. And in that case, I fell out of bed. And I thought, well, I've had too much drink or something. But I had that dream in various different forms. I should think a dozen or 15 times. There was always the business of the door. And I wondered whether it was due to experiences house clearing. What's on the other side of a door was always a big question. Or whether it was coincidence, I don't know. I think the answer to your question is not so far as I know. But I could construct theories about that series of nightmares if I felt disposed. You read all sorts of things into these things. By the way, I never finished telling you about my question to John Day, whom you've met. I said to him that in American movies, I'd just seen Private Ryan. I said, you know, I don't know. I said, these chaps get wounded and they scream and shout and their pals cry all over them and say, oh, Charlie, don't get away from us, Johnson. I said, I never saw anything like that. I said, people who were shot lay down, didn't make a fuss, and sometimes they died and sometimes they didn't. I said, John, did you ever know anybody who kicked up a fuss? Well, he said, I did have a chap in Normandy who screamed and shouted for about 12 hours, but he had lost three limbs. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I can believe people lost three limbs, but this chap was, you know, really very, very badly hurt. But generally speaking, people were very quiet. And generally speaking, they were quite unemotional about, you know, they'd go on patrol and you'd come back and say, how are you getting on? And say, oh, we're under a bit of trouble. Oh, really? Anybody get killed? Oh, yes. Who was that? Oh, Corporal Bloggs. Something like that. Do you know that famous ditty, First World War? The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling?
Yes.
Did you see the movie?
No.
I feel in the movie, they interpreted that song in the correct manner, that we saw the scene prior to a great battle, and the lads are digging a hole big enough to put about 6 double-decker buses in, obviously a grave pit. And they're playing some sort of tune, and they're singing and digging this great hole. The hole is duly finished, you then hear the noise of battle. You then go back to the hole, which is obviously full of bodies, and the men are putting soil on top. And they shovel the soil on top, they pat it down with their shovels, they put the shovel over their shoulders, and they march off. And they're singing, "The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling, for you but not for me," glancing in the direction of the hole, "for you but not for me." And that was, I thought, an overriding feeling people had. Nobody talked about chaps who'd got killed. They'd got killed, most unfortunate, you know. And people were, I suppose, in a theoretical way, sorry. But the main thing was, not that Charlie got killed, but I didn't. In retrospect, it strikes me as clear that from the day we landed as a unit in Europe to the day the war finished on the 8th of May, it was effectively one continuous battle, if you like, with long rest periods. It just rolled on. And the German army gradually disintegrated. And towards the end, it was not an effective fighting force anymore. But individual units, of course, fought on till the last day. So if one was unlucky, one might run into one of them. But it was one continuous rolling campaign. And that was it. It only lasted 4 months.